You are listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 168 for the week of April 16th, 2012.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. My name is George Albor.
I'm Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of games and culture. And games and culture actually intersect in a lot of other mediums, so we don't always limit ourselves to just video games per se. We've talked about documentary films on the show before, for example. Mm-hmm. Today, however, is our first foray into discussing a book and a piece of fiction at that.
Yeah.
If you've listened to the podcast recently, we've been giving you the heads up that we'll be talking about Ready Player One, and today that's this episode. Hopefully, if you've read the book and you got our notice, you've been able to follow along with us and can participate in the discussion, knowing what we're talking about with a little bit more depth. If you haven't, though, feel free to stick around. We're going to give a spoiler warning near the end of the podcast, but a lot of the stuff that we talk about I don't think is going to ruin the book in any particular way. Mm. Most of it is conceptual, and really, we're going to be spending a lot more time just talking about how the book sort of relates to our understanding of games and culture and pop culture in general, particularly 80s pop culture.
Right, right. So I guess for folks that haven't read it or need a little refresher, the book is set in the near future where an online service called Oasis, which is somewhat like a mashup in between Second Life and Facebook kind of,
and EVE Online, I would say.
A little, well, yeah, I mean, like, it is, it's basically a bunch of aspects of many of the online communities we have now, but it's grown so huge that it's become the default online community in the world, to the point where it's basically synonymous with the internet. You know, they don't even really talk about the web as disconnected from Oasis, you know?
Right.
And people, it's somewhat of a virtual reality thing, too, so in addition to the visual aspect of it, there's certain types of haptic feedback and various AR elements of it. But in any case, this company and this service has become the ubiquitous service on the planet, and the founder of it dies, and his vast fortune, the key to his vast fortune, his living will basically, was that there's somewhere hidden in the Oasis is an Easter egg, like the Easter eggs developers hide in video games, that would bequeath all of the money and all of the control over Oasis to the person who finds it. And right. Then it spawns a many years long search for this Easter egg.
In many ways, it's similar to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
The Chocolate Factory were a huge MMO.
Yeah, and it's good. I've after reading the book, I read a couple reviews and a little bit and a few interviews with Ernest Klein, the author, and he directly embraces that. You know, he talks about it as an inspiration, and you know, in many ways, it's a classic story. You know, there's the protagonist, what's his name? His screen name is Parzival. I always remember his
Wade.
Screen name.
Wade is his real name.
Wade Watts, right? You know, he's a 21st century street urchin type character who gets plucked out of obscurity because he finds the first key to finding the Easter egg.
Right, right. So I think we should talk a little bit about why we wanted to even discuss the book in the first place on a podcast that's basically about video games.
Right.
I had read the book first and then suggested you take a look at it. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I think that it's so significant is that, you know, in the fiction of the book, James Holiday, the founder of the Oasis and the creator of that, basically the huge MMO slash game, grew up in the 80s. And so the world itself is full of 80s film and video game and pop culture and D&D references, absolutely galore. And it makes up such an important aspect of Holiday's life that all of the puzzles that lead to finding the Easter egg that gives the Oasis to someone have to do with that type of experience of what it was like growing up in the 80s and playing old video games and playing D&D and watching, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off and
yeah,
you know, famous 80s films and pop culture stuff. And I think that Ready Player One's done really well for itself. It's very successful.
Yeah.
And I think that in the book, we can learn a lot about and discuss a bit about our own relations to 80s pop culture and the sort of ideas that Klein brings up that are related to how modern day culture relates to 80s pop culture and the way we revere certain things and are shamed about other things and mm-hmm. what the future holds for MMOs and social networks and all that stuff. It's really a rich book.
Yeah.
Theoretically, it's a young adult sci-fi, but that, you know, I don't want to sell it short by saying it's a genre piece because right. it's really deep, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I was a bit going into it. I was a bit worried about all the references because I feel like there's a real danger of just, you know, being a little bit too inward gazing, you know, references yeah. for the sake of references, you know, just to wink at people who know about Joust, you know, like and Adventure and all of the older games. But the nice thing about the story is that it's all justified because this designer of the game, you know, was pulling on his own experiences, and it's very relatable. You know, you hear game developers talk and you hear game writers talk today, and the reason they do what they do is because very specific games, usually that take place around the same time period. Like, because the book takes place in the 2040s, the same people that are being influenced today will be continued to be influenced, you know, in the decades going forward. So it makes sense, you know, there's a justification of why all this stuff would be around still. Like, it's always weird when people are obsessed with a specific topic in a film or a book kind of arbitrarily to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, why would people latch on to, you know, D&D if there was no specific reason why they would, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's interesting that you bring up, like, modern-day designers. Because while reading the book, I was thinking about Holiday as the sort of representative of all game designers, right? He's almost like a minor deity in terms of, like, he's like the essence of game designer, right?
Yeah.
Holiday is this imagined person who doesn't just know one aspect of the 80s. He didn't just play D&D.
Yeah.
He's played basically all video games from the 80s. And so the entire world, which really, you know, Oasis contains many, many worlds, worlds upon worlds,
mm-hmm.
all of them in which that he held in his mind.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to think about what game designers I might associate with someone like Holiday.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, he has some of the hallmarks of, you know, the stereotype of the game designer. Like, there's a lot of, like, John Carmack in there. He's socially mm-hmm. awkward. Like, he had trouble making friends outside of the context of making games. He had a partner, Og, you know, is his screen name. His in-game name was Og, but it was a very... It was kind of like a Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak relationship, you know, like one was kind of the paternal, avuncular, friendly guy, and the other one was the more aloof and reclusive one. Mm-hmm. And so you're right, it's like a mashup of a lot of familiar aspects we have now that, you know, it makes sense would continue to persist as time goes on.
Yeah. And we've talked on the show before about what it means to be a representative of the games industry and whether or not we have certain rising stars or people that are generally recognizable amongst the, you know, the majority population.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in the book, everyone knows who Holiday is,
yep.
right? He is incredibly famous. And like you said, he's very much like Steve Jobs, right? When Steve Jobs passed away recently, it was like everyone knew about
yeah.
it. And of course, that's not entirely true. But certainly the people that we know and the communities that we frequent, and, you know, we're in the Bay Area, so everyone basically knows who Steve Jobs
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
And people were mourning outside of iStores yeah. and stuff, and or Apple stores. And it was very strange because Steve Jobs was someone who made products and had certain ideas, but we don't usually associate a CEO with a sort of cult of personality. And it's strange seeing Holiday in the book as a game designer because I you know, trying to imagine a future in which games are really big and significant and a major part of everyone's lives, I'm not sure someone like Holiday could exist or, you know, or maybe even reading this book makes you think about what it means to have your products created by an individual.
I was thinking about also, you know, while I was reading it, you know, trying to find another analog. And I think it's key that Oasis in the book started out off as a game and then kind of morphed into a social network. I mean, mm-hmm. in the book, eventually, Oasis becomes the place where the richest people go to school and have jobs and everything, because the external world has been basically ravaged by poor land and resource usage and, you know, gridlocked politics and over corporatization. And so, like, the Oasis is the best place to go for many services, including like cultural services as well. But right. since it started off as a game, it was spearheaded by an individual about and for a certain purpose. Like, I was thinking about, like, could this happen with someone like Zuckerberg? Like, when Zuckerberg dies, what will happen to Facebook? But, like, Facebook kind of started off as something decentralized anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, in the same way that everyone from my parents to us to younger people knew about Steve Jobs, because it's, you know, it's one person really driving forward a vision of what a company is supposed to be like. Zuckerberg is more kind of overseeing this company that creates the illusion that the people taking part in it are the ones building it, you know?
Yeah. Although, I have a funny anecdote I actually want to share. Mm-hmm. Someone on this past Friday, some friends and I went to a local bar here in Stanford, and inside the bar, there's a picture of Mark Zuckerberg mm-hmm. with a few other Facebook founders sitting in that same bar,
mm-hmm.
right? Apparently, it was a bar he frequented long ago when he was first starting Facebook.
Yeah.
And while we were sitting there having drinks right next to this photo, this group of young women came in and started taking photos of the photo of the Mark Zuckerberg in the bar that we were in.
Uh-huh.
And it was just so weird, and I don't understand why someone would take a picture of a picture.
Uh-huh.
But I think it fits this discussion really well, because even though Mark Zuckerberg is ostensibly just leading what is supposed to be a larger thing, people do still see him as this idol
right.
of, you know, modern internet entrepreneurialism yeah. or whatever.
And what will happen when he moves on? You know,
I mean, I hope he has a game, basically. I mean, I hope he has that he gives it away in candy wrappers. Yeah.
I mean, the world outside of Oasis in the book was pretty fascinating to me as well, mm-hmm. because, you know, everything in this book is just a couple steps into the future of what we have right now. You know, obviously the haptic feedback suits and the fidelity to which you can interact with the virtual world is beyond what we have now, but I mean the concepts are all there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm currently reading Neuromancer, and it's kind of blowing my mind because it was a little bit before all of the internet took off in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to imagine what that would have been like to read it then. But reading Ready Player One, we can already kind of imagine how this world will work, because we kind of have bits and pieces of it. We just don't have the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, we have MMOs.
Yeah.
We have Second Life. We have Facebook. It's really about putting the two together.
Well, and we also have the external world that would lead to the rise of something like Oasis. Like,
yeah.
outside the virtual world in the book, you know, no one really cares about the politicians outside. Like, Wade makes a comment how he doesn't bother voting in the presidential election, but he bothers voting for who leads Oasis, right. which happened to be like Will Wheaton and Cory Doctorow or something, which is kind of a funny reference, which makes sense. Yeah, yeah. You know, like a 50 or 60 year old Will Wheaton will be like, you know, running for king of a virtual world.
I would vote
world.
For Will Wheaton.
but yeah. I mean, I didn't necessarily feel like the book was very hopeful in many respects. Like, I felt there was many, many times while I was reading the book where I was pretty depressed.
Yeah,
I don't know. Did you have the same reaction to it?
Yeah, it is somewhat depressing. I mean, I'm kind of used to that with sort of post-apocalyptic fiction, mm-hmm. which this sort of is.
Yeah.
And I actually really liked one particular aspect of it, which is that class and poverty remains an issue,
yeah.
even though you're theoretically in this world in which class and poverty shouldn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people talk about the technological singularity and the future of everyone having access to the internet, I think that there's this assumption that class and poverty is just going to disappear now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad that Ernest Cline kept that as a significant part.
Yeah.
You know, like, Wade struggles with his ability to do anything in the Oasis because he's so poor, both in in-game currency and in real-world currency.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one point he has to sort of sell himself for sponsors
mm-hmm.
so that he has money to remain in this virtual world longer.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that aspect of it. It's a little bit depressing, but I think that it's far more realistic when we're talking about the future of technology and social networks and the like.
And, you know, the major conflict in the book revolves around a competing company. IOI is the company that is also looking for the Easter egg, because that means they could basically execute a corporate takeover of Oasis. And, you know, Wade and a bunch of other people are essentially like freelancers that are trying to find the egg for themselves through, you know, various systems of like good sportsmanship and honor. They don't want to clan together basically to find the egg. But, you know, I as the book wore on, you know, obviously IOI is a big greedy corporate entity. Like,
they're very evil in the book.
Exactly. You know, the lead guy is this kind of, I don't know. I thought of him as kind of like the main guy from The Watchmen, like the Ozymandias guy. Like, I don't know. He's kind of sleazy in a darker way than something like, you know, the Waz would be. And, you know, like they literally kill people in real life to prevent them from getting to the egg and so forth. Right. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I started seeing IOI and GSS, which is the good company that runs Oasis, as the line between the two started blurring after a while. Like, you know, Wade was stuck on his home world inside of the Oasis for a long time because he didn't have the money to get off, right?
Right.
And he was limited by what he could do because he had kind of a crappy computer rig and he didn't have a really good internet connection. And, you know, all of this cost money. Like, to get to places, it cost money. To get better items and armor, it cost money. And it just seemed kind of strange that where we draw the line between what is an admirable company and what is an evil company.
Yeah. Especially when you think about the sort of in-game economics, you know, because it's not like that's any more perfect than real world economics.
Yeah.
And that the effects, especially when the effects are so important, right? Like, take Facebook as an example. If you meet someone, and I'm sure you probably have, who does not use Facebook, it's pretty weird these days. Like, everyone uses Facebook.
Yeah.
So, you know, imagining everyone using Facebook being even more ubiquitous, but now all of a sudden there's paywalls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people start to question, well, what do we have a rights for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even relatively recently, the UN has been weighing on and discussing whether or not access to the internet is an aspect of a basic human right.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the world of Ready Player One, I'm not, like you said, I'm not so sure that GSS as a corporate entity can be inherently good, right?
Yeah.
And as far as I recall, isn't there a moment where there's like a board of directors who don't necessarily want it to be just given away to a player? Am I remembering correctly?
There may have been. I mean, there was always like the lawyers and stuff that, you know, he even met them like after he won the egg and everything.
Right.
Like, I mean, there was some careful stewards of it, but, you know, Halliday and Og, you know, were pretty careful as to how this was all set up.
And I guess that's it, right? Like, you get the sense that the only way for this world to be good is by having it be steered by good people.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, we talk about this all the time in the video game world. I mean, we all love Valve and we all love to hate EA, you know, but like, they're both really huge corporations that have an undue amount of influence over certain aspects of the industry.
Right.
And it's like, you know, Gabe Newell's is a great guy. You know, I love him. You love him. Everybody loves Gabe. Who wouldn't love
everybody
Gabe?
Everybody loves Gabe.
You know, but I mean, like, many of the things that they do are very similar to the things that all the other companies do in terms of, you know, downloadable content and monetization. And, you know, Steam itself is a very restrictive system that we only like because it's so far it's been working out for us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the lines between, you know, the most hated company in America or whatever that is supposed to mean versus someone who's almost universally loved like Valve, it just seems very thin, you know, like that, that we can flip on that really easily.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You know, there's a couple other things to think about as to who is truly important in the world. Like, as I was thinking about, you know, it's crazy that Wade isn't voting for the president. But then if I were given the chance to either vote for who would be able to run Google versus who would be able to run the you know, presidency of the United States, I'd have to think about it pretty carefully, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the same issue comes up internationally when, you know, people have written academic papers that they're mostly poking fun at the idea, but they question the seriousness of it as well, is that when your country is being so affected by U.S. policies, maybe you should be allowed to vote for the U.S. president, even though you live in, you know, Turkey or something.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, who influences your day-to-day life most directly and most frequently? So it's like, it's the idea that, you know, one corporate entity has so much power in day-to-day life. It's not, I don't know, it just, it wasn't as far gone as I expected this to be. You know, I expected it to be a much further flung future. And, you know, it's, I guess there's elements of cyberpunk in it too. You know, he lives in a stack of trailers, you know, instead of like, you know, land and resources are at such a premium that Wade and the rest of the poorer folks like him have just built skyscrapers out of trailers.
Right. And it's like the most ghetto apartment complex you could imagine.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah. You know, as the government infrastructure is continuing to crumble. No one's really making any huge, like, this is what happens when we no longer are enthusiastic or worried about outward technical innovation, and we just turn inward to the internet. And like, in a country where we are destroying any kind of investment into infrastructure, like building bridges and so forth, you know, like, we're not looking to go into space anymore. The most innovative things are actually happening online, right?
Yeah.
And like, people's day-to-day lives aren't, they don't have that focus anymore, you know, like yeah. How people live and the way that the government safety nets work, like, it's not all that far off from what happens, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sorry, I'm being such a buzzkill, but like, there is like really poignant parts of the background world in this book.
Yeah, I completely agree.
There's happier things too.
There is, yeah. So, well, actually, moving on, and I think we'll come back to the way that the outside world and the inside world relate when we talk about the very end of the book.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to know your thoughts on the way that the book sort of reveres the pop culture experiences of Holiday in the 80s and whatnot. And it's really funny because you get the sense that everyone in the world is now so focused on potentially winning this award that they become immersed in pop cultures of a time long past, right?
Yeah.
And you see a lot of references to games from the 80s, but presumably the games from the 90s still exist, and the Knots exist as well. So it's weird because I feel like part of the book, at least from Holiday's perspective, is this reverency for material from the 80s and this reverency for the cultural experience that Holiday had growing up.
Yeah.
And an attempt to salvage that, right? That, like, we're forgetting what adventure was like, and we're forgetting what D&D 1.5 was like, and that we're going to lose something permanently if we don't remember that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it seems like they're also forgetting some, you know, modern material. And, you know, you and I kind of grew up in the 80s. I was pretty young in the 80s, but I still think back fondly on a lot of the same things that this book covers.
Right.
And in many ways, this book felt like it was written for me, right? I would turn a chapter and I'd get one reference and then another reference and then another reference. And it was such a weird feeling and it felt really cool. And I'm like, oh, I'm in on it. I see this. I get the joke. But then it's still so focused on one particular cultural experience that it almost feels exclusive.
Well, I was thinking about that aspect when towards the end of the book, they figure out the last clue of, you know, the last key to the egg. And it's three is a magic number cartoon rhyme. And I totally saw it coming too. I was like, oh, I know exactly what this is going to be. Like, I recognized the little lyrics and stuff. I was like, this is going to be three is a magic number. And it was. And so
because three is a magic number.
It always has been. But I mean, nine. It is. I went back and forth on this because there's a certain part of me that really enjoyed all of those references just because it was a nostalgic thing. But then I thought to myself, well, is this just the equivalency of, like, our parents watching Forrest Gump or something and, like, seeing all, you know, hearing all the music again? Like, oh, I get that reference. I remember LBJ, you know, like that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird because, like, this works for us. It works for you and I.
Yeah.
But we could imagine the same world being done in, like, the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, or like maybe there's Mork and Mindy references instead of D&D references.
Yeah.
You
know? I mean, it's it flirts with it a little bit. Like, it's a little bit indulgent here and there, I feel like, just because of, you know, the nature of it. You know, this is something that is very lovingly crafted, you know, a love letter to all this stuff that was happening. And when it, the times that I was a bit disappointed in it were the times when I started thinking about the broader cultural significance of it. You know, is it were any of these things associated with a larger context, be it political or economic, cultural, or is this the glorification of a subset? You know, like, it,
right.
There's a certain, I don't know, inadequacy I feel because of, you know, people who grew up listening to Bob Dylan had their pop culture intricately tied in to the political realities of the time.
Right.
Whereas something like Adventure is a much more niche phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You know, like, no one was humming the tune to Pac-Man while they were tearing down the Berlin Wall or anything. You know, like, it just just wasn't as wide, you know?
Right.
And so I'm kind of worried that, like, we're glorifying all this stuff, but we're just glorifying it for the sake of memory or nostalgia, maybe. Like, there isn't, you know, like, what is the significance other than it helped shape how we think of ourselves, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's partially the point, though, right? Because there are parts of this book where Wade in the Oasis goes and visits, like, the childhood home of James Holiday, the founder of Oasis.
Right.
And I think some of it is you get the sentimentality for the game itself, but you also get the sentimentality for that specific experience of growing up in that home, of having a family in that place. And I think that really interesting and very true about the way that Ready Player One talks about how pop culture can fundamentally shape a person's identity,
right,
and everything about it. And I think that sometimes when we talk about, I mean, maybe not you and I, but the wider cultural discourse about things from the 80s or you know, like, you get those nostalgic t-shirts that's like, oh, you know, back in my day, I had to blow in a game before to make it work,
exactly. Right?
Things like that. And they're funny and they're jovial and they're lighthearted, but in all seriousness, part of our cultural experiences and our pop culture experiences are every bit as important as maybe who our parents were or right. where we lived in the world. And were we growing up in a rural community or a apartment in suburban community?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, Holiday is someone who is so fundamentally made by the games that they played. And you get the sense that it's almost sad because there are moments where he wishes that he could have had experiences outside of those created by, you know, artists and game designers and filmmakers.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not like he's a bad person because those are the experiences that make up his life, you know? Like, there are a lot of books that I read as a kid and games that I played as a kid that I know today are still incredibly powerful in terms of shaping who I am. And I think that Ready Player One manages to, yeah, at some points glorify it, but really more so focus on the fact that they're important as pieces of our own identity.
Well, and, you know, the idea that we're taking these, I mean, I feel like for our generation specifically, and, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of bias here just because I can't remove myself from it. You know, we're really shaped by the internal worlds that we created. I mean, we grew up in the shadow of this huge generation of post-war boomers, you know, like,
right.
they've dominated the economic and political landscape for years and will continue to dominate it for several years more. You know, we're looking at another 10 years, basically, until the next generational shift starts happening. And,
right.
you know, pop culture was so dominated by them that these types of virtual worlds that we had to kind of manufacture ourselves. Like, we had to manufacture an identity that out of nothingness, basically. You right. know, like, the way to rebel was not through something external. The way to rebel for me was, like, getting into games like Mortal Kombat because it was something that they just couldn't understand.
Yeah, or like Magic the Gathering because there was witches on it and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, there was something so foreign to them that they couldn't understand because, like, there was no guitars associated with it or there were no overt political messages to it. Like, it was something so alien that it's hard to, there's no reference point, basically. Like, we created an identity out of a different set of cultural icons. Mm-hmm. And it's, some of it is just, like I was saying, like, insecurity. Like, is this really a good thing to kind of build your identity around? But some of it is out of necessity. You know, like, what is the most different thing I could possibly do from, like, my parents' generation? It's to buy into something that they have a really hard time understanding because they just didn't come of age while it was happening.
Right.
And so, like, in this world where they're dealing with the fallout of the political and economic decisions of that generation, like, it's kind of poetic that these make-believe worlds now kind of hold the key going forward. Like, they're finally being brought into the physical worlds, you know? Like, D&D is now determining public policy because of how these games worked, you know? Like, because of how Oasis was built.
Yeah, and it's cool, too, that the world of the Oasis is... It's very much in the sort of modern understanding of online identities being unique and powerful and strong things, because, you know, you're talking about making your own identity from what you have. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people in the book, right, H and Artemis and Wade themselves, their avatars aren't necessarily similar to their real world selves.
Yeah.
And I think already you get this understanding in modern day that our internet selves are different from our real world selves, and they're different from ourselves when relating to certain different people. Mm-hmm. And so just, it's not a stretch to imagine that much farther in the future, you know, gender and race and all of this on the digital space being very different and being defined very different, and maybe being a good thing in terms of allowing you to shape your identity as you wish.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's probably a good point to kind of give a spoiler warning so we can talk a little bit about the characters and the end of them a bit more specifically.
Right.
You know, so for folks that are interested, you know, just be forewarned that we'll go into some of the end game stuff here. I was really happy when the whole H and Parzival relationship manifested itself in real life towards the end of the game.
When they met.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I during the whole book, my one big disappointment was I didn't feel like the sex and race dynamics could have been, you know, were as played up as they could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And then when, you know, H's rolls up in what we think is his RV, and it turns out that she has actually been a black woman, also gay, the whole time.
Yeah,
it's a great little, you know, it redeems it at the very end, you know, like it goes into that, it goes into those dynamics really quickly.
I also love that there's this moment when they're in the car, and it's a really funny moment, I think, as well, where Wade's like, oh man, like, does this change things?
Yeah.
Right. Now I know who this person is in real life. What does this mean? Mm-hmm. Are our experiences, because they were digital, like, less fake?
Yeah.
And then they you know, they make some joke, and then they immediately fall into their online behavior.
Yeah.
And I like that because it feels so rewarding, right? It's reminding you, just because it's in a digital space doesn't mean that your experiences and your relations are any less real.
Right, right. And you know, I think Klein handled that whole relationship well. Like, there was only a few lines about it, you know, where H was explaining, like, well, you know, if you are a certain type of person, the internet is not always a friendly place. And that completely clicked for me. It was like, yep, that's completely true. It will probably sadly be true for the next, for the foreseeable future. And it's like, you know why a black woman would want to create a generic looking avatar, you know, especially when they're in this kind of underground community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I felt the same way about Shoto and Daido.
Yeah.
Who, for a good portion of the book, you think are brothers, and then they, you know, they just turned out to be online friends.
Yep.
And that's, again, it's a nice touch, and we never, you know, sadly, we never meet Daido. He dies or whatever because of the Sixers. But that's really cool. I think all those aspects, when they actually finally meet, and even when they meet Ogden Murrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's, you know, he's like a larger-than-life character. There's that great scene when, in like his sort of discotheque, where he's just like spinning tables, completely ignoring the battle around.
And he's also like dressed as a wizard too. Like,
yeah. I mean, I have to say, like, he's probably one of my favorite characters from the book.
Yeah,
he seems like he just he was having such a good time and had so much trust that everything would turn out okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's cool to finally meet him, and you get the sense that you can be an adult, you could be someone who went through these experiences, and be a fairly well-rounded person.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, definitely. The relationships are, you know, and they strike home because we've all had those types of relationships on the internet before, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to create identities and trying to parse, you know, what are these people actually like? You know, I've been talking to this person for a month on a message board, but, like, you know, who knows what they actually... And, you know, for the entire book, Wade is pining away for Artemis, this woman who he's in love with, but he, in the back of his, every once in a while he says, well, I hope she's a woman, you know. And you know, at the end, you know, she actually confronts him about that too, you know, before she reveals herself. You know, she always tries to tell him, you know, well, I could just be some dude in his basement somewhere. And, you know, there is a point where he thinks to himself that he doesn't care. You know, like, he's made this connection. He just wants to meet her, you know?
Yeah, and it's strange because there's this... there's this dichotomy, I think, in that him not caring thing. Mm-hmm. Part of it is like him realizing, okay, well, I'm kind of a loser too.
Yeah.
So even if you are a dude, well, then I'll just be in my basement and we'll only ever interact online.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, you know, kind of sad or pathetic, if you will. But then there's the other aspect of it of like, no, I really want to generally know who you are as a person, because the piece that I do know that's online is really interesting and really cool.
Yeah. But I mean, thankfully, because this book is largely a hero story, it turns out that she's actually, you know, a quite pleasant young lady, and they, you know, get together at the end.
Yes, of course, of course. So one thing I want to talk about, and this relates to what you were saying earlier about it being depressing, but so at the end of the book, Wade finds the egg, mm-hmm. which is literally an egg.
Yeah.
And Holiday's hologram comes out and says, okay, you are now invincible. You're basically the owner of the Oasis.
Yep.
And also, here's a red button. And if you push this button, the internet goes away. Yep. You basically destroy the Oasis.
Yeah.
What did you think about that? Because I feel like, to some extent, it's kind of a bullshit out, right? Like, there's this sort of... I mean, I don't actually believe that. I'm mostly being sensationalist here.
Well, but, I mean, in what way? Like bullshit it as to how easy it would be to dismantle it, or bullshit because he's given the choice at all?
You know, for a book that's so reverent of this material, to also be... to keep a little bit of that shame, to keep a little bit of that peace inside where you think, maybe I am wasting my time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the very, very end of the book, the last sentence is Wade with Artemis in the real world.
Yeah.
And Wade feeling like he doesn't actually have to log back into the Oasis, that he's happy outside of the Oasis right. for like the first time in his life.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And it's cute. And that's wonderful and all. But doesn't that sort of devalue what they're saying earlier about your experiences in the Oasis being just as powerful as they are outside?
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar response. I mean, you know, the whole book is about a quest for balance. You know, like you want to make sure that IOI doesn't take over and start microtransacting people to death, basically. You know, like, but you still want to make sure the Oasis can keep going, so there is some necessary monetary interactions that have to happen. And, yeah. You know, like, Wade, you know, wants to, you know, be really cool and everything inside the Oasis, but there's also the physical realities outside. You know, like Artemis was saying that if she wins the fortune, she's going to make sure everyone on the globe is fed, basically.
Right. And so right. They want to like literally transform the world into a better place instead of having people hide away inside the Oasis.
Yeah. And I mean, Wade's plan for a big chunk of the book is to is to create a spaceship and just go and just like,
which
get
is,
off
like,
Earth.
The most awesome. Yeah.
And so there's this constant tension of, you know, what are we escaping from? Is it worth trying to fix what we're escaping from? And if we are able to fix it, do we need an escape anymore? I expected the Oasis to disappear at the end of the book. Like, that was my prediction as I was reading. I was like, oh,
like,
well,
he would,
you know,
push the button, you mean? Or that it would just disappear?
No, I expected that once he got the egg, it would be like, oh, and the real secret is the friendship you learned along the way. And then it would just delete the entire thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, that almost, and when he saw the button, I was like, oh, here it is. He's going to push it. But then in a really brave move, they just kind of gloss over. They're like, oh, by the way, there's this big red button. Be careful about this and think about it carefully before you ever press it. But then, okay, on to the next room. Here's another cool thing, you know, like.
Yeah.
And so like, good.
I was just going to agree with you. I do really appreciate that, you know, it's a choice that's like, here you go, but let's move on.
Yeah. And I was thinking to myself, like, would that even be a legitimate thing to do, to like delete Oasis? I mean, it's become so ingrained in their society within that book that, I mean, you'd be erasing a huge amount of the global culture, right?
Yeah. And that's one of the strange things. It's also like a database for knowledge and for, you know, like they have this great education system that basically equalizes education.
Mm-hmm.
In some way that I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
And then you touched upon it as well. There are people who have a legitimate reason maybe to escape. You know, Wade grows up in this like shithole town where people would probably beat him if they saw him just walking down the street.
Yeah.
It makes sense that he wants to spend his time online. And so it'd be strange if he were to push the red button and have everyone's escape taken away from them before they have somewhere else to go, before they have another security net.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, part of it is because, you know, Holiday was kind of a sad character. You know, he did escape into the Oasis because he was unhappy. You know, Yeah. Life didn't turn out exactly the way he wanted it to turn out, and so, you know, the Oasis was his Oasis. But it's interesting that he built that button in there, and that his words of warning to Parzival were, you know, just be careful, don't spend all your time in here, basically. Like, yeah, there's a life out there. Which, again, there's a lot of tension in that, and what happened in the rest of the book, because there really wasn't much of a life out there for any of these characters, you know?
Yeah, I mean, for all we know, it's like Mad Max out there, you know? Maybe
it is like Mad Max. I mean, like, H is a mobile command station. Like, she lives in an RV, like, like rolling around, so IOI can't kill her, you know? Like, you know, it's a bleak world out there. I don't know. I kind of wanted him to get rid of it at the end. I felt like he had learned everything he could learn from it.
But it's so cool.
And you know what? That final battle scene, there's an epic battle scene at the end where, like, everyone gets huge robots from, like, the old, you know, Japanese, like, Toho era monster movies. And you know, there was a hilarious scene where the IOI people had all of the Voltron robots. Yeah. And then the you know, the shield comes down, and there's this huge battle between all of the normal people on Oasis and all of the corporate army on Oasis. And there's just one line about the Voltron people after they were built up. It was like, yeah, the Voltron team was destroyed before they could even form the robot. And it was like, the battle starts, and instantly just a wave of massive destruction happens. And then more stuff happens. Like, Mecha Godzilla comes up, you know?
And I love the way that everyone in the Oasis is involved in that.
Yeah.
Like, people are bringing ships of all shapes and sizes, from, like, Battlestar Galactica Vipers to, like, Star Trek Enterprises.
Yeah.
To, you know, like, from every pop culture world. It's such a cool battle.
It's kind of like that old Flash video, The Ultimate Showdown, like, where Chuck Norris and Godzilla and Shaq are all fighting and stuff. Like,
how could you end that? How could you push a button to end that? I mean, you know, the way that I saw it was, you know, the button was like an ejection seat, right?
Right.
Like, if things were ever so messed up that you have to pull it, if IOI has basically taken control over they're enslaving digital people
or
whatever,
right,
push the button and end it. But that seems like such a, you know, a last measure. So
it is, but it also makes me wonder, because, you know, once Wade finds the egg and becomes the leader of Oasis and effectively the leader of the free world, now that it, you know, it's such a powerful position to have, you know, where does he go from here? You know, like, he'll need all his friends to guide him and to direct him, because his only goal in life was to get to where he was.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you do when you reach the end of a game? You know, you delete your save and start again, right? I mean, you know, it's like, where do you go from there?
That's a good point, too, because really, it's not like Wade knows much about global economics or environmental stewardship.
He knows a lot about Monty Python, and that's pretty much it. Like,
oh, yeah, that's a shame. Would you be interested? Okay, so a couple of things. One, would you be interested in a sequel to this? Do you think that there's more to explore? And two, you had mentioned that the screenplay has already been picked up.
Right,
how do you
right.
think this would appear as a film? And do you think that there's an audience for this type of experience?
Well, I mean, you know, this is about video games, and there's always room for sequels in video games. You know that. I mean, it would be interesting to see, you know, in a way that reflects how video games are moving right now. I think it would be interesting to see Oasis stories. You know, like, you know, Parzival has things wrapped up pretty well, but, like, there's still going to be a lot of factions of IOI that are hidden in darker corners of the Oasis.
Yeah.
And so in a similar way where you could do, like, Liberty City stories in Grand Theft Auto, you could do, like, Tales from the Oasis type thing, you know?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I like that.
Yeah.
And you know, as a film?
There's a bunch of us that will pay for this movie, so, you know, I don't know.
I'm concerned about the licensing agreements that this film would require.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it seems pretty much impossible, like, all of the different technologies and companies that are there.
I mean, maybe you could claim fair... No, no.
No, no. IOI would stop that.
Yeah. I do think that it's interesting that the book has done so well, and, you know, I almost feel like the book might be losing its relevancy as the years go by.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, in the sense that, you know, if we were to look at the, 18 to 25 demographic, at this point, between the 18 and 25, you are more than likely born in the 90s
yeah.
or maybe late 80s.
Yeah.
You know, you and I are on the very tail end of getting a lot of these references and jokes.
Right.
And a good deal of them I don't get. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't watch a lot of Japanese monster television shows and things mm-hmm. like that.
You're missing out, man.
Apparently, yeah. Clearly I am. So, you know, I wonder, even if this did become a film, what type of audience would go to it? You know, like, I think that there's still a visceral reaction when you look at something as old and dated as, you know, Tempest.
Right, right. Or Joust or any of those other big...
Oh, yeah, or Joust. You know, I mean, they're still... I mean, don't get me wrong. They're awesome.
Yeah.
That's fine. But, you know, if you're having a... Like, look at something like Community. Super tongue-in-cheek.
Right.
Super self-aware. And there's a lot of committed fans to Community, but it's also, in all honesty, not doing all that well as a television show.
Mm-hmm.
And not really anyone's surprise. You know, it's not particularly accessible. I think Ready Player One is accessible, but maybe that's just because I know, you know, a lot of the references and I play games already.
Well, there's also a generation of people, you know, kind of starting with us and then growing older that, you know, these are the formative experiences. Like my dad, before I could really read them for myself, my dad read to me out loud the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And right. So there is now a growing market of people kind of our age and a little bit older that want to make sure that the next generation remembers Joust.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and so it's like, and you know, every once in a while you'll see Barack Obama do like, you know, the Vulcan salute basically. And it's like, so there's like a generation of kind of like Gen X and beyond type people who, for them, this is now turned into a historical project. You know, they want to make sure that their identity persists a little bit. So, I mean, as far as a movie goes, it would be, you know, it would be targeted at people that grew up alongside this stuff and want to make sure that it's somehow enshrined going forward. Because, you know, the world feels like it changes really quickly. Like, I was looking for Zork the other day because I kind of wanted to play it. And I had a hard time finding a really quickly available and playable Zork, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like they want to, you know, there's a preservation impulse too, I feel like.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, just this past weekend, I watched The Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal with my niece.
Yeah.
As a sort of like, yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to, like, impart to her, like, you know, this was important, not just because it's a good story, but because it changed the way I thought about stories and the world and how I wanted to see myself, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But then again, like what you were saying, the practical realities of mounting a project like this are insane, you know? I mean, can you imagine trying to put together all of those old games and making them, you know, it's hard. It's hard to film that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. If I'm going back to this red button, man. I'm thinking I might press it.
Oh, man. Well, then I'm going to have to stop it, basically.
Well, this is where it starts.
I will be Mecha Godzilla. You could be Mothra or whatever. We'll duke it out.
All right, I guess we'll wrap it up there, huh? For, you know, for people to mull over and you know, as always, if you have any comments or questions, suggestions, we'll throw out our email address here. It's experiencepoints@gmail.com.
And of course, if you haven't read the book, again, it's Ready Player One. It's by Ernest Cline. You should be able to find it everywhere you look. And it's pretty good. I think I would recommend it, even if you're not super into reading sci-fi or genre fiction in general.
Yeah.
I think it's worth a look. And again, if you ever find a book that you think is really interesting that it would be relevant for the Experience Points podcast, let us know. The site is experiencepoints.net. Of course, Scott shared with you our email address. But again, visit the site and check out some more of our stuff.
All right. Until next time, everyone. I'll see you in the oasis.
The oasis. Go to, because I